In Galatians 6:7, it describes a law or a principle of life, and it says, do not be deceived, God is not mocked. I mean, this will come to pass. It doesn't matter who wants to argue with it, this is an unalterable principle of life, that what you sow, you also reap. Now, there are some things about harvesting that if we can understand these principles, it makes a lot more sense out of the ways of God. Now, I was raised on a farm in Kansas, and we raised wheat, milo in Nebraska. When I lived there, we had a chance, or I didn't raise corn, but knew a lot of men who did. And so harvesting was a very crucial thing. But there are some laws that went into what these men did and how they behaved, and they apply to you and me. First of all, you harvest in the fall what you planted in the spring. If I plant corn, I'm going to harvest corn. If I plant dandelions, I will harvest dandelions. In your life, you will harvest in the fall what you plant in the spring. It's a given. The second thing is that if you want to harvest good, you then must plant good. But the third thing, if you want to harvest failure in your life, plant nothing at all. Here's why. In Proverbs 1, 28 and 29, it illustrates something. Wisdom is speaking and says, then they will call to me. Now, it's speaking of people who are at the fall or the autumn of their lives, and they ignored wisdom in the springtime. In the early years of their life, these people ignored wisdom, and instead they followed foolishness, being naive, being mockers, scoffers, and that list that we find in that proverb. At the end of their lives, you would think, couldn't they just turn around and change things then? No. Now, they didn't have a life strategy of somehow we're going to ruin our lives. It's just that at the end of things, they couldn't change what had happened. It had happened by default. It says that they will call to me and I will not answer. They will look for me and I will not find. They will not find me, since they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. The fourth law of the harvest is that you harvest more than you sow. You can plant one kernel of corn and you raise thousands. Now, the positive side of this is if you want to have a life at the end of your life, it is a prosperous life. And when I'm talking about prosperous, I'm not describing money. I'm describing that sense of peace of soul, a satisfaction that says, I have chosen the right things in life. You want to have that in an abundance? You sow a bunch of it now, and you will have more than you know what to do with at the end of your life. That's a law. And the fifth thing, you can't grow success where failure already, and you can't grow success and failure on the same spot. I'll explain that a little later. Now, let me give you kind of a wide-angle shot of your life. And let's look at your life in terms of seasons. And I'm talking here about your adult life. I got this this particular analogy from John Crawford up in Oklahoma City, and I think it's very useful. But he says you can describe your life as having a springtime, a summer, a fall, and a winter. Now, for all intents and purposes, I want us to think of the spring as basically your 20s. There's not this absolute line that happens when you turn 30. But the Bible seems to indicate that around 30, something shifts in your adult responsibilities and your adult patterns. I know that happened in my life, and I've seen it in several other people's lives. So for tonight, we'll talk about the spring being your 20s. But I'm going to take the rest of my time and try to really address this. What do you do in the early part of your 20s, since how many of you are over 25? Okay, I've got this audience under 25. So we will address what do you do in that early half of the springtime of your life to see to it that in the winter you've got a harvest. Let me describe the springtime. It's a time of planting, whereas summer is more of a time of cultivating. Those are those mature years. I'm smack dab in the summer of my life. The autumn, now when that one starts, I don't know, but we'll let Max be in the autumn. Harvest time. I mean, all these years, Max, are paying off, aren't they? He doesn't have to work as hard. He tries. But he's got us working that hard because we're in the summer. But it's paying off. Those years and years and years of sowing and cultivating are now, he's harvesting that. The winter of your life might be those latter years that some people arrive at, those in American culture we retire, but it's not just they when you're off, but it's that time where you really are sitting back and enjoying. It's in the spring that you start a family. It's in the summer that you raise a family. It's in the fall that you're helping your family start families. And then it's in the winter that you're enjoying your family's families. So what's unique to the springtime? It's a time of growing in wisdom and knowledge. It's a time of concentrating on setting roots more than it is on bearing fruit. It's a time of establishing right values, right habits, developing character, developing a life vision. It's a time for you're strong, there's a lot of vitality, dreams are big, and it's easy to imagine accomplishing the impossible. You eliminate harmful and distracting elements during this time of your life, if at all possible. And like I mentioned, you begin a family. As you move on into the summer, where I'm at now, the will of God becomes clearer and clearer. I am not at all surprised when people your age are having a hard time figuring out, what does God want me to do with my life? That seems very normal. Now, some of you might have that figured out. Some of you might have it down and is so decided that, and you may be right. But what I see as normal, if this is any help for the rest of us, is that you have some general ideas and some inclinations, but exactly what it's going to be, it's still kind of vague. If that's the case, I wouldn't worry about it. But you do know a few things. That if you are going to be able to be following Him in the summer of your life, when He makes it clearer and clearer what it is He has for you, you'd better sow the right seeds now. And so keep in perspective, it's a time of sowing and sowing and of getting the soil ready. We'll illustrate that more fully. But here's why it's so crucial. You may know me. I'm your constant companion. I'm your greatest helper. I'm your heaviest burden. I will push you onward or drag you down to failure. I'm at your command. Half the tasks you do may as well be handed over to me, for I'm able to do them quickly and the same way every time, if that's what you want. I'm easily managed, and all you have to do is to be firm with me. Show me exactly how you want it done, and after a few lessons, I'll do it automatically. I am the servant of all great men and women. And of course, I am the servant of failures as well. I've made all the great individuals who have been great, and I've made all the failures also. I have all the precision of a marvelous computer with all the intelligence of a human being. You may run me for profit or you may run me to ruin. It makes no difference to me. Be easy with me, and I will destroy you. Be firm with me, and I will put the world at your feet. I am habit. And the habits you establish now, those patterns that become routines in your life, those seeds that you sow now are crucial. And if you don't sow the right ones, by default, you are sowing something else. So, having made that point, paradigm is kind of the hot word these days. It's kind of a fancy word that means the way you look at something. And a few years ago, as I was working on this issue in my own life, like, how do I make it to the end? I really want to arrive in Rio. I want to make it to the winter of my life and to look back and to say to my wife, honey, we did it. We fulfill the will of God for our lives. Instead of, honey, we've blown it. And so I started asking the question, how do you finish? How do you finish? Not how do you start, but how do you finish? And so as I began asking that question and looking at life from the perspective of a finisher, I thought, well, how do I find out how to finish life? I thought, well, there's a book written on it. I wrote a whole 66 different books about how to be a finisher, so I thought, I'm going to read what this book has to say about finishing. And so I looked at the lives of people in this book, and I began to ask the question, what made some finishers, what made some failures? And then I began to look at who are the men and women that I respect their lives. I could honestly say they are finishers, or they certainly are finishing. And I looked at their lives. And then I love to boil things down to the lowest common denominator. And I ask this question, is there anything common in these lives? I think I've found four things that make up a finisher. Now, the next speaker that gets up here might have five. Someone else might have three. I'll not quarrel with them. But I see four things that I want these to be habits in my life. And I work at these things on a weekly basis to make certain I'm sowing these seeds and cultivating this soil. Here's what these things are. A finisher, number three, there we go. The one prior to that. Thanks. Fundamental to everything for a finisher in the Christian life is this all-consuming purpose of pursuing Jesus Christ. He is everything. He is the description, the definition of everything. Paul said that I might gain Him. When he had lost everything, he said, I am content with Jesus Christ. And so the definition of a finisher starts with somebody who has decided, I want Jesus Christ more than a career, more than a family, more than possessions, more than success, and on and on and on. It's when that person says, I count those things as loss, and in exchange for that, I want Jesus Christ. That's where finishing begins, is that decision, that determination. And so I said, I want to keep that foremost. But then I see these people doing four things that keep this pursuit of Christ ever before them. I see them being wholehearted. I see them being unentangled. I see them working out the will of God. And I see them being honest with pain and weakness. Now we'll develop these points. I thought, how do I start thinking like this? I worked on these ideas and I thought, I want to come up with a definition of a finisher. Really a definition I want to live by. And so I came up with this. See what you think of it. You might want to improve it. But I see finishing as the wholehearted, unentangled pursuit of Christ. Resulting in, meaning, He's the one who leads me in His will. He's the one who empowers me. He's the one that even gives me a reason for living. So I don't have to go accomplish something in life. What I need to do is find Christ. And He's the one then that as I get to know Him, He will lead me in a direction. So I need to be wholehearted and unentangled in my pursuit of Him. And that then results in the working out of His will. It starts out very broad, wondering what I should do. I'm at a point now, I've got a pretty good idea of what it is. And I work it. And it's becoming clearer and clearer over the years. And I do this in the midst of pain and weakness. Now, how do you get a handle on these things? Well, I've seen that for a finisher, they have these four principles that I just explained, but each one of these principles seems to have a discipline or a pattern that seems to be associated with it. I see this in the biblical characters. I see this in the people that I've looked at in this life. And I see people who are seeking to be wholehearted, they're aided as they practice spiritual disciplines. That's non-optional in their lives. They've decided, I will be disciplined spiritually. People who are unentangled in life and remain that way have a teachability in their lives. I'll explain why that's so critical. and why the unteachable person will get tangled up with something else. People who are carrying out God's will understand their shape, and they have some sense of a mission that they can explain. They can say it in one line or in a paragraph. They've thought it through. And then people who endure pain and weakness. This one's a tough one. I don't know how to put this into one line, but one thing's for certain. The more pain and weakness they encounter, the more they place value in heavenly things rather than earthly things. That's where their focus is. So how do you, first of all, be a wholehearted person? That's an Old Testament word. Or it's used frequently in the Old Testament. It's used in the New also. But an example of wholeheartedness. Caleb was a man who in his 80s was still pursuing Christ and the vision that God had given him. He was working it out. And he made this statement about himself in Joshua 14. Three times he uses the word, "I have been wholehearted." That Hebrew word means full. It means my heart has not been partially full of Christ and partially full of something else. It doesn't mean I'm just sort of dinking around with it or piddling around with it, or it's something I do if I have time. It's something that floods and fills my heart. The capacity of my heart is full. Now, the heart is crucial. And here's why. That's the seat of your motives, your attitudes, and your values. And the Proverbs say to keep watch or to guard your heart with diligence, because out of it flow what? The springs or the issues of your life. So if you want to know the direction of your life, you'd first of all got to start with your heart. What's wholeheartedness look like? Well, let me ask this. Do you have inner convictions, things that you just won't budge from? Those senses of these are right and I don't compromise? Do you keep your promises? In other words, do you have integrity in your life? Do you do the best you can possibly do when you do something? Do you know how to tell the truth? Do you have a double standard in any of your relationships? Do you cheat? Do you compromise principle when it's to your benefit? Do you live by priorities? Do you display loyalty? Do you respect authority? Do you admit when you're wrong? And do you're candid about your failures? Are you obedient? A whole heart looks like that. Now you're asking, great, Edwards, that's inspiring. How do I do that? Here's what I see finishers doing to keep their heart whole. They are people committed to spiritual discipline. Finishers are spiritually disciplined people. Now, let me explain something about spiritual discipline. It's not a very popular word. Discipline is not a popular idea nowadays. But I heard it said not long ago, I've heard it said several times, you can be disciplined and not be spiritual. But you cannot be spiritual without being disciplined. There has to be some things in your life that you say, I will do these things. And the thing about spiritual disciplines is that they make a man or a woman get honest about what's really going on in their life. It makes them stop and think about who am I and what's really happening. Am I being half-hearted or are my motives pure? At the base, at the bottom of all finishers are people who have routine quiet times. Is that something you treat as optional? Or is that something that you are working to make that thing a valuable, fruitful part of your life? You see it in the Bible. You see it in finishers in this world. But also, gang, there are people who develop the capacity to have extended time in prayer. They're people who, when they go to public worship, they put their heart into it. They don't worry about if they're entertained. They go there to please the Lord. They're wholehearted. They're people who do Bible study and get their answers from the Word. They're people who meditate on Scripture and get their set their mind on things above. And they're people who have learned the skill of journaling, keeping track of what God's doing in their life. Now, these are going to work in different ways for different people. But, gang, these are going to be essential if you're going to be a wholehearted person. That inner part of your life is going to be pure. Now, what about being unentangled? Well, Jesus tells an illustration, it's a story. But it's illustrated in my backyard, which I have a bamboo patch. And bamboo is the toughest stuff I have ever had to mess with. My wife has continued to say, honey, we've got to get that stuff out of there. But you can't cut it down because the stalks are hard. And if one of our children slipped and fell on them, it's dangerous. And so the only way to get rid of that stuff is to dig it out. One stalk at a time. And it is like digging trees out. And so we have this thing about the size of 5 football fields. And this summer I dedicate my life to finishing that task. I got rid of this stuff. So why, if you were to come to my house, do I have bamboo growing there now, and wheat, and Bermuda? Well, Jesus tells a story. He said, there was a man who went out and sowed seeds. And the seed fell in different places. One of the places it fell in Matthew 13. In fact, I believe the passage is in verse 22. He says, the seed fell on a place where there were weeds or thorns. And here's what happened. The one on whom the seeds had sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, but the worries of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. This really bothered me. I thought, if a person's wholehearted, shouldn't they be able to live a life that doesn't get all caught up in things? And yet it describes here somebody who heard the word, received the word, and got a good start. In fact, the crop started growing. Just like that Bermuda that I planted started to grow. So how come there's wheat, of all things, and bamboo growing in the middle of it? Well, here's why. Because I put straw on top of that Bermuda grass once I seeded it to keep the ground moist. And guess what was in the straw? Seeds. And guess what seeds do? Grow. Anything wrong with wheat? Nothing wrong with wheat. My dad makes $1 million growing this stuff. But what's it doing in my backyard, my Bermuda patch? Now, there's a lot of things that aren't wrong, but that are going to crowd out the crops in your life if you sow those seeds there, and they will, over time, gradually grow up and just choke out the good that you're trying to do. But how come there's bamboo there? I dug this stuff up. Simple. There's still some roots that I didn't find. And now everything looks good except that these roots are still growing. And gang, unentangled is that tricky dimension of the Christian life. You're constantly working at it. There's always things crowding in your life, new things coming along, opportunities, ideas, relationships, all sorts of things. Kind of like the wheat. It just gets added as you go. And if you're not careful, it can grow up and crowd out your seed. But there's some roots in your life that if you see those things there and they keep coming up, if you're not careful to get rid of them, they will grow up and ruin your yard. So how does a person stay unentangled? How does a person who's trying to be wholehearted stay unentangled? I looked at the Bible and I saw a pattern that finishers apply. I see finishers in this world applying the same thing. And it's called teachability. It's a pattern that if you want to have the right course in life, be teachable. And in a broad sense, what that means is that you're eager to receive the truth that God brings into your life through the agency of other people. You don't pick and choose who you're going to listen to truth from. You'll receive it from whoever it comes, no matter the pain that might accompany it. Now, as I was a young Christian, we got this drummed into our lives. They kept talking about be teachable, be teachable, be teachable. And I'm grateful now. I'm grateful now that I decided I was going to listen. Here's why. Remember, Jeremiah says the heart is very deceitful. It'll fake you out. A wholehearted person can still fake themselves out. I know I shouldn't eat some of the junk I eat, but I took my son to Brahms last night. Why didn't we go get carrots or apples? Because my brain convinced me that the worth of that single dip with my son was of higher priority than a carrot or an apple. That sounded like a good decision, right? I loved every bite of it. Now, Brahms is all right unless I live there. That'll kill a guy, right? So, your mind, you will fake yourself out. And some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. But other people can be real candid with you and say, hey, it looks to me like such and such. Let me show you an illustration about mentoring and why it's so important. Mentoring is the idea of other people in your life who are holding you accountable. They're sharing the truth of God with you. And here's an idea of kind of how it works. You want to have older people in your life, those people who are your models, your instructors, your inspiration. They're kind of your coaches. There's those people that are a little further along in the Christian life than you are. And you are receiving the input that they give to your life. Sometimes it's just somebody you hear from a pulpit. Other times it's somebody that's very close to you and they're training you. It might be a parent or a close relative. And so you need those kinds of people in your life. You're teachable to them, but you're also teachable peers. They may not know more than you, but there's a lot that their lives contribute to you. They're your friends. They hold you accountable. In fact, this is something you're really sharing with each other. You give each other support. You're a team, but they shape your values. You need to have them in your life. And then there's value in you being a mentor to someone else. There's a sense of accountability and a real sense of learning that comes. I gained more out of this message than you will ever gain because I had to work on it just to give you a little bit. And the same thing's true as you try to be a mentor with somebody else. You're the one that's really growing. You're the one that's trying to be a model. You're the one who's being an instructor. You're the one who's giving inspiration. But there's accountability, there's learning. And what it does is it helps you begin to see, hey, there's some things in my life that are just, if I'm not careful, they will crowd out the good. And I need to keep myself free from those things. Let me briefly mention something about this third principle of working out the will of God in college. And then I'm going to ask one of the students to come up and give a testimony about how God's been doing that in his life. You know, I made the comment that finishers, as they get to know God, they also begin to work out the will of God. I've discovered you can't know God fully without walking wholeheartedly and earnestly in His will. And that always involves ministry. It's not just what's God's will for my career. God's got so much more for you than just a job someday. Jobs change. Most of you will go through several different jobs. But you will have a sense of I'm on a mission. God has designed me for something and I'm contributing something. While you're in college, I think there's a few things you can do that if you will get these roots in your life, years from now, it'll be paying off in that being able to do the will of God. We've nicknamed it SHAPE. And this is the idea of learning what your spiritual gifts are, learning your heartbeat, those things that, I mean, you just really enjoy that aspect of life. Some of you are counselors. Some of you love the hurting. Some of you love the ones that need to, the intellectuals. Some of you are into leadership. Some of you are into missions. Some of you are into administration. Some of you are teachers. There's a heartbeat that you will have. And the more you know Christ and do His will, you begin to have this sense of this, I must do this. So you want to identify that. We can help you with that. Your abilities. Every one of you has got a different set of talents. God didn't give those to you for no reason at all. He's got a purpose for those things, and He wants you to know what they are and to develop them. And to develop them now. We saw talents being exercised just a few minutes ago in the band. Didn't they provide a tremendous ministry? But that takes time to develop. And yet they're doing the will of God with it now. Personality. Some of you are outgoing. Some are not nearly as outgoing. Some are very task-oriented. Some are very people-oriented. Some of you are very structured, do everything on time. Some of you wondered where you left your watch. But that's fine. God uses all of that and wants us to recognize how we're made. And then there's a set of experiences that you have got in your life. I've got in mine. It's no accident that you were raised where you were raised, by the parents who raised you, in the various sorts of elements and pain and joy that you experienced. The things you've been through. In fact, I can't help but believe that a great part of your ministry in the future comes from benefiting from experiences. Which, I won't have time to delve into the whole thing of pain and weakness. But gang, finishers recognize life hurts many times. But instead of cowering from that and always looking for the easy way, they have decided, even though it hurts, even though it's strenuous, even though there's disappointment, we will follow Christ in those painful times. There is something about the goodness and the grace of God that they discover in pain that they can't discover anywhere else. And once they discovered that, there's a depth in their life. There's a capability of describing God through their experience. And other people go, that person knows what they're talking about. They've been through it. And so don't waste your experiences. In fact, while you're in college, I want to challenge you to put yourself in as many different experiences as you can. How many of you have been to a conference or a training program since you've been involved with the BSU? How many of you grew from that experience? I know some of you have found it a life-changing experience. We've got two big conferences coming up in the next few months. One's going to be in Louisville. It's called Mission 95. There's going to be a video playing about it when we go downstairs for refreshments. And gang, give some serious thought to going to conferences. Another's going to be at spring break this next March when we go to Colorado Springs. Give priority to those things. Go on mission trips, even though you think, I'm not interested in missions. Let those experiences develop you as a person. It was hard to figure out who to ask to come up and give a testimony about that. But we've asked Eric Stater to come. And just to give you a little idea of what he's done in college to put these things into practice. And then I'll wrap it up. I want to close by doing a favor for you that a man did for me my junior year in college. I could probably describe my life as kind of like a cup of Coke spilled out on a table. It's there on the table, but would you drink it? Probably not. And that's kind of where my life was. It was kind of a little here, a little there. All my potential, all my experiences, my spiritual gift, everything was right there, but nobody could use it. God was having a hard time using it. Until my junior year, In fact, if somebody my sophomore year would have given the message I just gave you, I'd have probably thought, that's right. And I'd have been wholehearted about it for a little while, and then I got off wholehearted about something else. And how in the world do you, when you're 21 or even 18, tackle the wind? I mean, think about that. He said something to me one day in the union. He said, Dave, I'd like to help you so that 20 years from now, you're still walking with God. And there was something about that. I thought, you know, it's hard to imagine 50 or 60 years from now. But I can imagine 20 years from now. And I can do that. And so there's sort of this intermediate goal that he gave me. That was 22 years ago. I'm on my second 20. And I owe so much to that sentence. And I want to share that sentence with you tonight. 20 years from now, when you are in the summer of your life, will you be cultivating a healthy crop that you sowed in the spring? Now, here's what he basically did for me. He kind of took that Coke and put it in a cup. Now, there's the same amount in a cup that there is on the table. But what's the difference? Because it's got some structure to it, it's available and usable. And he kind of gave me a sense of structure. And so let me leave you an idea that might give you some structure to this whole thing. How in the world do you do it? I took this description of a finisher, this wholehearted, unentangled pursuit of Christ, resulting in the carrying out of the Lord's will for you in the midst of pain and weakness. I knew that's what I wanted to be. And so I thought, I want that to shape every week of my life. And so I wrote up something I call a personal mission statement. That might sound a little bit too harsh. So somebody else might call it a purpose statement or just your purpose in life. But Jesus was able to say, I came, and then he would fill in the blank. Jesus knew his mission and could say it. And I thought, I want to be able to do that. So I took this definition of finishing and I turned it into a statement that I review and make my priority every week. Let me show you how I do this. Here's my purpose. It's to know Christ as fully as possible. I will pursue Him with my whole heart, giving special attention to my motives and my attitudes. I will also remain free from any habit, relationship, or activity that entangles me. Essential to this pursuit is my sincere practice of spiritual disciplines. And also I must remain open to the ministry of others who instruct, observe, and evaluate me despite the pain and humility that accompanies it. So there's that wholehearted, unentangled element. And then I tried to articulate the working out the will of God. Christ enables me to fulfill a unique mission. This mission includes several fundamental relationship roles that deserve my best efforts. That's my structure. I give these relationship roles highest priority in my thinking, my schedule, and my personal development. And then I am a man, I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm an educator, I'm a pastor teacher, I'm a staff member, I'm a son and a brother, and I'm a friend and a citizen. And I give priority to those things. I also recognize that life involves pain and weakness, and I will receive I will receive this fact and benefit from it. I will allow Christ to reveal Himself and to build His character any way He chooses through the difficult things I face. I will finish my mission well. I have no option. And so what I do every week, I try to do it on a Sunday afternoon. Instead of planning how busy I'm going to be this week and let basically everything else run my life, I sit down with God and pray for a half hour, 45 minutes, and ask the question, Lord, what are the spiritual disciplines you want me to work on this week? Who are those mentors who will I need to be teachable to, and I need to place priority on those relationships. Who are those people, and when should I do that? What should I do with my wife this week on purpose? What should I do with my son? Guess what? I need to spend time with him. My daughter, I took her over to Baker's Dozen this afternoon. She loves to go on dates on campus. That was a priority. I stopped this to do that. And it makes me face my pain on a weekly basis to stop and ask the question, Lord, is there anything I've really kind of put off or ignored when really I should grow from it? Now, sometimes there's some very clear things I need to do. Other things there's not. But what it does is it gives a structure, a glass, for me to be following Christ in a busy world instead of a busy world basically just crowding out what God wants me to do. Let me suggest you come up with some kind of a definition. Maybe one line for you. For me, I had to expand it. And determine 20 years from now, when you're 41, you won't be like my neighbor last night who asked the question, Dave, why is everybody's life our age falling apart, as he told about his neighbors, people at work whose lives are falling apart. And as he told about how a couple of years ago, his nearly did also, if somebody hadn't kept him unentangled.